Blog Talk Radio.
Aloha, welcome to Talking Pictures. I'm your host, Paul Booth. We thank you for joining us today. It is always a pleasure to do this. And today we're going to be discussing Elizabeth Taylor, classic films, James Dean, Montgomery Clift, Rock Hudson. We're going to jump all around the great works of Elizabeth Taylor, Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, the great director Mike Nichols, all sorts of goodies coming your way. And we're happy to be here doing this because we love talking movies, and I'm going to be joined by our podcast producer, Jim McNulty, who loves talking movies as much as anyone. And Jim has been watching movies for 50 years. He's 70 years old. So he brings that special understanding and knowledge of cinema to where he saw so many things when they came out that we're only left to find on Turner Classic Movies or video stores, but I guess those don't exist anymore. So these are some special episodes to pay attention to. We're mainly going to be discussing Giant, which was James Dean's last film. He was killed during the editing of it. Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf for Elizabeth Taylor was one of her Oscars. And that was Mike Nichols before The Graduate. Of course, most of us think of him as The Graduate, but he's made so many other great films. To me, Mike Nichols' worst film is better than most people's best film. And then A Place in the Sun, talk about controversy. We're going to discuss a film that just flat out broke the rules. Coming out in the early 50s, had taboo written all over it and could not have been more just out there with its subject matter. What I always like to do that we haven't done for a while is give some recommendations and discuss what we've all been watching on Netflix. I've really been on a documentary, comedy, classic film kick lately. And it's always nice to study a lot of different genres. I'm waiting for the producer to call in here, so I apologize for this little bit of what seems like me just scraping for content. We want to jump into this conversation here that we've been preparing for weeks about Elizabeth Taylor and her leading men. And you know, Elizabeth Taylor, something that we're going to discuss today is how she means completely different to Jim's generation than she does to mine. To my generation, you know, I think of movie star, I think of Meryl Streep. Elizabeth Taylor, by the time I was old enough to really know what movie stars were, I was engulfed in the way newspapers and media overtook her personal life. And so it just kind of, I don't want to say ruined the art for me. I don't want to say I don't respect or appreciate her art, but I say give me Meryl Streep any day of the week. And right now we're going to be bringing Jim in. Are you with us, Jim?
Yep.
Excellent. Thank you for joining us. This is our fellow podcast co-producer out of, from Hawaii, San Francisco, many other various adventurous places around the world. But now he resides in Grand Junction, Colorado, about 4 hours in some direction away from Denver, or 8 hours if you take the wrong highway. So recently we had a great journey. Jim and I got together and we actually tested this episode. We did a couple of test episodes that we're going to do tonight. So one thing that Jim and I have a goal for you new listeners, because I know we get new listeners every week, is we want there to kind of be a kind of like we're at a coffee shop talking film with friends. So if I take a drink, or if you hear Jim drinking, or if there's some ambient noise, we just want people to kick back and feel comfortable. And we are working towards getting callers to be able to call in. So this will eventually be a show that you two can also be involved. With that, Jim, I already let them know how we're going to be jumping into Giant, Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, A Place in the Sun. I had mentioned Mike Nichols, James Dean, Rock Hudson. I had yet to get into Montgomery Clift as much. But I think with your great story that you have with Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, I don't think we need to go in chronological order here. I think we should kick it off with the Mike Nichols classic, Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf.
All right, Mr. Booth, I'm ready for the blogosphere. I'm feeling a little bit festive tonight. To paraphrase Norman Desmond in Sunset Boulevard.
Oh, yes. Gotta love that movie. For any of you those out there that said, what's that? Wait till we're done talking, turn us off, and go on Netflix and watch Sunset Boulevard. But fire away, Jim.
Okay, Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf? I am, George, I am. Anyhow, back when I first heard of Virginia Woolf, it was on a vinyl. I think it was 8 records on both sides. And actually an ex-lover and I had broken up, and we didn't have a heck of a lot of money. So when I found a place to live, he moved in with me. And we listened to Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf constantly. And we pretty much, what got us through the breakup was using lines from the recording to just sort of have fun with one another and get through what we were going through. And a good friend of mine, Jerry Bilgard, told me later that because he came over all the time, and he said that it was the best show in town because he'd come over and listen to us just doing our riffs back and forth. And it was fun. And it was Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf. I had the Uta Hagen and Arthur Hill recording of the play. And then I saw the movie with Elizabeth Taylor and Burton. And it was awesome. I mean, that movie was such fun. They went at it. It was no way around it. It should be a classic. I don't know how other people view it, but in my life, it's up there in the top 10. Her voice in that, even, you know, from her earlier stuff, I mean, way back, not when she was a kid, but most of her career was sort of grated on me, even though I loved her. And you know, her beauty just, you know, overshadowed that. But for that movie, she dropped it down to her balls. And, man, it was fun. It was fun. A good movie, well done. And like I said, as far as I'm concerned, it should be considered a classic. And it's, you know.
Oh, yeah, I mean, it definitely is. I mean, but please proceed. It definitely is a classic, no doubt, and is considered one.
Yeah. No way around it. Have you seen it?
Well, for me, it's interesting. And you know how I like to throw little tidbits at the audience so you can really understand the further context of this film. It has an 8.1 on the Internet Movie Database. This is 1966. So we're at a time where the production code is falling and the Catholic Legency, I'm not knocking Catholicism, but they had no right to ever control cinema content, and that's my opinion, no one else's. But 8.1 is very high on Internet Movie Database, and just what Jim was saying here, the synopsis here is a bitter aging couple with the help of alcohol use a young couple to feel anguish and emotional pain towards each other. When Jim mentioned performing this with his lover, ex-lover, friend, this was originally a play, and of course Mike Nichols comes from the theater, and that's why I think Nichols always had such a strong understanding of character. So to make Elizabeth Taylor, to know to change her voice, to know to grab those nuances, I think do happen in films. But what I'm learning, and especially as we've talked about this film, is that it's the theater directors who really nail the nuances, because they can't rely on editing, they can't rely on cinematography, they can't rely on a soundtrack. So it all has to be there in the moment. So back to your question, for me, I unfortunately have not been able to see it because the first time I ever saw it, I was just too young. I believe that you need to be ready for a film, and I constantly have that debate with people where they think that we have nothing to do with the movie we're seeing. And I tried to see it a second time, but the second time I saw it, I have to walk a thin line here, because a lot of people who listen to this show will kind of know, you know, who I dated. So let's just say I related to the problems that alcohol can cause in a relationship, and I'm no saint. And so the second time I watched it, I made it through about 30 minutes. And it was tough for me because it was Haskell Wexler, who shot my favorite film, Coming Home. It won 5 Oscars. I'm pretty sure it won, you know, it got Elizabeth Taylor her Oscar. She also won one for Butterfield 8, which we'll talk about in the next episode. It got Sandy Dennis an Oscar. Haskell Wexler picked up cinematography. Richard Silbert, production design, and it got best costume. And it also had 2 other lead actor nominations. So it had 4 nominations, and of course Nichols, his first movie, making a best picture nominee, directing one. Of course, he won the next year for The Graduate. Jim knows to stop me from going on a Mike Nichols tangent, so I'll stop myself before I do. But for me, go ahead.
Paul, I want to jump in on that. You said that Mike Nichols sort of directed her towards that, you know, bringing her voice down a bit. And when you said that, it immediately came up for me. I mean, she was an incredible actress. And I really wonder if it was his call or if it was her just understanding the intensity of that interchange between her and her husband. You know, it just came up for me.
Oh, no, you know, and I really like that because it's an interesting thing because we never know. And I like that you bring up that point because I think I think it's more so like I think Sidney Lumet is another great example where like that scene in Dog Day Afternoon when Pacino's talking to his lover and he knew that he had to have them talking on the same time in a different room. You know, that's a theatrical nuance. That's not something that a screenwriter or, you know, so many directors would say, oh, we'll just edit it later. So I was just more so getting at the nuances, whether it's the actor or the theatrical director, knowing to go with that. So I definitely do. I can completely agree and see what you're saying. And especially since I haven't seen the whole film, I can't dispute it. So I appreciate you bringing up that point because that is always the great mystery that we don't know, you know, who decided to do what. And when you have a film that had I mean, music, score, sound, writing, directing, 4 acting nominations, 5 wins. I mean, when you're talking into 11, 12 nominations, you're talking about Ben-Hur, you're talking about Titanic. I mean, I think you're even passing Lawrence of Arabia in nominations. So there's so much that goes into it. I can't wait to see it. I mean, I'm going to try to see it again next time I can find it.
Yeah, no, you know, my feeling is that it wasn't Mike Nicholson that inserted that, because Elizabeth Taylor was up against, in the, you know, play itself, Sandy Dennis, who was a rather timid, small-voiced actress for the part. And my feeling is that Elizabeth Taylor would have known to act off of that. So, you know, I don't know if you agree with me, but that was, you know, I love Elizabeth Taylor so much. I want to, you know, come up with her sainthood.
Oh, no. Well, you know, I was mentioning that before you called in that it's impossible to not have a change in how you view an actress or a director based on generation. And I was using my example of Meryl Streep. You know, when you have 23 Oscar nominations and you have and you've been doing it for just over 36 years, that's pushing that every time you do something, you get an Oscar nomination. And, I mean, she was even in that Into the Woods movie last year. I think she was in 2 scenes and got an Oscar nomination for it. So it's kind of a, there's that joke that Jared Leto made that he wanted to introduce the 4 nominees, and then, in accordance with California state law, Meryl Streep. And it's kind of become where it's like, what other actresses than Meryl Streep are going to get the nod? So with Elizabeth Taylor, what interests me here is we had this talk when we were in Colorado doing test episodes, is that I can see the talent, and of course I grew up with my grandmother talking about her, but I had mentioned, and I would love to hear your input on this, I had mentioned right before you came on that as I've thought about it more, what I think kind of not ruined Elizabeth Taylor for me, but made me watch Giant and say it's a James Dean film, or made me watch A Place in the Sun and think it's a Montgomery Clift, George Stevens film, is not because I'm sexist or because the leading men are better, but because I was really growing up in that gossipy, too much of her personal life. Pardon me to the audience. I just burped. I apologize. Excuse me for that. The gossipy and it moving further and further away from the craft. And so I didn't really get told the way you say, watch Sophie's Choice and it's going to change your opinion about Meryl Streep. Or I didn't know too much. I still don't know too much. I don't even know if Meryl Streep has ever been married or how many kids she has. And I think there was just that peak in the 80s, might have even went into the 70s, where it went from... and please correct me if I'm wrong, because you were there, because I'd love to learn, if it almost went from movie star to just what a cultural icon has to deal with.
Yeah.
No, I mean, so what do you think about that? I mean, you saw it evolve.
Well, you've mentioned before that, I'm an old gay man, okay? And the movies were going over like Giant, Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, and then we come to A Place in the Sun. And I realized that I was a kid when that came out. That came out in, I think, 51. I was only 6 years old. And I don't actually remember when I saw that the first time. But as far as cultural icons, I think Elizabeth Taylor, well, you know, I've read somebody said something like that, that she was the last great, you know, from the old system in Hollywood. And there was a long period of time where I followed, you know, intimately followed. I saw a lot of her movies. I mean, I saw a lot of them. Elephant Walk and Suddenly Last Summer and, you know, that type of thing. And I don't know, you just to tie that up with something else, you said that when the film censorship board was going, you know, there's still a certain degree of censorship that slips in there in a, I don't know, a sort of pernicious way that, you know, that is still alive in Hollywood. And it wouldn't think from some of the stuff they put out, but it's still there. And it still sort of reflects our culture. I mean, there was so much in Giant, in, you know, A Place in the Sun, that really did deal with stuff of its time. I mean, so much so that, you know, A Place in the Sun was considered, you know, way out on the edge a long time ago. And now it's, you know, even though it's viewed as a classic, it's still, you know, people, like someone your age seeing it, some of the stuff they deal with is going to seem sort of tame, or at least do they to you?
Oh, well, I'm glad that you said that, because just to kind of tie in what you said here about, we have just a straight shot in a row of Suddenly Last Summer with Montgomery Clift in 59, and in 58 we have Cat in a Hot Tin Roof, which of course is Paul Newman. I highly suggest, I think I've seen one Paul Newman movie I didn't like, and I think it was really just because I was comparing it to his classic. So sadly, they are hard to find. If you can get out there and find Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, if you can find these films, just as much as you find them for Paul Newman or Montgomery Clift, seek them out for Elizabeth Taylor. We won't even get into what a scary time we're living in film right now for films being lost and ignored. But with Cat on a Hot Tin Roof, as we go two years before that to Giant, for me, I can kind of remember, and I believe I'm really sorry that I lost your question, you know, my little brain issue that goes on.
So we matched one another on that.
Pardon?
I said we matched one another on that brain issue.
Yeah. I'm so sorry. I think it was something about it, about the, not her translating how she, what she is. And for me, of course, my mother was a little bit older than you, so she was the generation of Elizabeth Taylor. She just so happened to say watch something because of Paul Newman, because I later learned on in life that my grandmother's as biological as anyone, so it was about the blue eyes, not necessarily the acting sometimes. And but with Giant, when I first saw Giant, she had mentioned to me to, it's a film that sticks out in my head so much because there was so few films that my grandma would just see in a store and buy. And she wouldn't say rent it. She would just say, you have to own this, even if it takes you years to get it or understand it. Just, this is one you need in your collection. And that was one that she grabbed for me. And I remember just being so enthralled by it. It has its classic scenes. You know, sometimes there's going to be spoiler alerts on this show, but sometimes I kind of feel like our audience who's listening has more than likely seen some of these classics. So with Giant, you know, James Dean, his last film, his second posthumous Oscar nomination, that brilliant scene that you pointed out to me that I rewatched on YouTube, when you said to me that James Dean was not fighting to be rich or equal, or that it was about the love and the affection that he didn't have. And as soon as I watched that, as somebody seeking the love and affection that so many of us, you know, look for and can't find,
That felt like for me, or you know, my thought now is he seemed to have been looking for that in his life. So the rawness of that, you know, translated beautifully into the movie.
Oh yes, yes. I mean, definitely James Dean and his story and his moving around and his ups and downs. And you know, James Dean to me is one of my favorites. Where people think he just made it overnight. And I read a thing on the internet the other day where someone was saying, how can you be seen as such a legend? You only made 3 films. And it really kind of just made me kind of think, well, you know, if you had an option to make 3 films that kind of changed your craft, versus 20 films that 18 of them people don't remember, you know, I'll take the 3. And Giant was, to me, I remember I watched that, and of course, Grandma was right. She said, do not put it on after 9 o'clock at night. If I remember correctly, it's like a 3-hour-and-50-minute movie. And I just remember being up at 2 in the morning, just enthralled, could not go to sleep, didn't want the movie to end, did not know I was in the hands of a master like George Stevens. That was my introduction to him. But with Elizabeth Taylor, as I went back and saw some of these scenes, she's so amazing. And I think what I just realized, Jim, now as we're discussing this, that and again, not in a sexist way, purely talented way, but you know, let's just face it. If George Clooney looked like the Hunchback of Notre Dame, some of his talent wouldn't have the allure that it does. So Elizabeth Taylor is in her 40s, 50s, whatever, seeing her do movies as a young kid is not going to affect me the way when I saw her in Giant. It was not like, oh my gosh, look how sexy it was. It was just the talent, the beauty, the whole package was there. She could steal the scene from James Dean, even though the scene was about his breakdown and Striking Oil. And that is what I think is something that possibly leads to the change and difference in how our generations view it.
The part she was playing was, you know, to contrast it to Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, she was very, she was very much the partner, the wife, the mother, the evenness with which the woman she was playing confronted life. And that contrast in the movie between where her trajectory was going and where James Dean's character was going. Just, you know, she wasn't always bombastic in the roles that she played. And that's just, you know, it was a beautiful job of delineating who she was, the character she was supposed to be.
Oh, yeah, no, I mean, that's a really valid point, because I feel like, you know, it's a constant thing to this day. I mean, I even heard, I read an interview with Julianne Moore where she said, oh, well, I won an Oscar last year, but in 2 years I'll have trouble finding work once my looks decline more. And
yeah, okay.
And there's those actresses who, it's an interesting thing, because I feel it, I'm trying to think of, let me click on it here, of a later Elizabeth Taylor movie that's not her Oscars or Cleopatra Almost Sinking Fox, that's something where it would be old enough for me to be conscious of it. I'm born in 79, and I mean, she has episodes of General Hospital. She has episodes of TV miniseries North and South, Sweet Bird of Youth, which is a TV movie, but I could have swore that was a Paul Newman or Joanne Woodward movie from the early 50s. And it seems like she was on Murphy Brown, the Flintstones, The Nanny. So I think what was really coming across here was a later in life actress, to where the younger generations, unless they went back and picked up on it, like the way we joke with Jim, if you could please, because I can't say it again, explain to us what Alec Guinness's real best performance is that is not Obi-Wan Kenobi.
Go on.
No, go ahead. Please, tell us.
Alec Guinness. Oh, no, he had, a long career, but who I was thinking of was Peter O'Toole, who, had an incredible body of work. And I don't know why nothing is coming up on Alec Guinness. I've got movies just going, flashing behind my eyes right now, and I can't think of any of the names.
Well, there's, I mean, the main thing is he got his Oscar for Bridge on the River Kwai.
There we go.
And he was in Dr. Zhivago. I would have to look up here, now that we're talking about Peter O'Toole and Lawrence of Arabia. Now, I believe, I'm fairly sure here, I might be wrong, I'm going to look it up. And of course, we lost him 2 years ago. Is that he was nominated for 8 Oscars, and I believe only won an honorary Oscar.
Yeah, well, that happens a lot.
I mean, that's Robert Altman, that's Kubrick, that's Chaplin, that's Hitchcock. But when you look at Peter O'Toole, this is kind of interesting too, because I think when we looked at Elizabeth Taylor the other day, she had 6 or 7 nominations. As I see here with Peter O'Toole being nominated for The Lion in the Winter. Of course, that was a Katharine Hepburn Oscar. Now, odd side of the fact, go ahead.
A great movie, a really great movie.
I really need to watch it, because the last time I found it was on VHS, and the second tape was messed up, and I just remember being so. That should be a crime punishable by 30 days in jail, but I digress.
There you go.
Little fact here that's interesting for what we're talking about here, about the way actors burst on the scene. Peter O'Toole, first nomination, Lawrence of Arabia. And now we will jump back to Elizabeth Taylor, so we have some facts to share, because we both love little tidbits. But let's jump into A Place in the Sun, which of course, is, like you said, tame. But 1951, wow.
Yeah, exactly.
So fill us in on that one, Jim. Your experience. You kicked that one off.
Well, like I said, that came out, correct me if I'm wrong, I think it was 51.
Yeah,
and
51.
Like I said, I would have been 6 years old at that time, so I know I didn't see that movie at that time. And I couldn't tell you when I did see it, but it was in, you know, it had to be when I was younger, maybe in my 20s, something like that. And I was, at that time, upset by the ending. And I didn't get the larger implications, the subtlety of what was being shown, you know, the interior of the character. That because it almost ends on two tracks. One is, you know, the him being convicted and people going, you know, because he killed her, when in fact he ignored the fact that he was swimming away and she was drowning, and came to see that he let her die. He killed her. And since I've seen this since then, you know, and I've talked to you about it, I sort of understand that a little better because I really was younger. You know, we talk about the difference in our ages, and there's the fact that, yes, I was younger at one time. And it really did color my perception of the movie. I never forgot it because it upset me so much. And I guess that I was still young enough to, and still idealistic enough that, and part of the culture at that time, that it upset me. And today, what that deals with, or what it dealt with, people would not be very, you know, it's like it would be almost a so what. You know, and we've been confronted with such much more thorny moral dilemmas. Although, you know, that was a moral dilemma for him, but in his realization. But, the territory we cover nowadays really does reflect our culture today.
Oh, yeah, I mean, definitely. I for me, the film could not have been more night and day different, not only because Jim and I are basically, we're basically half each other's. I'm half his age, or he's my age times two, just under that. And so we've had this really interesting way that we can talk about films where you can't deny that there's the 30 years of understanding stuff or going through stuff, or maybe you've been through a film or had that experience happen. And so A Place in the Sun, for me, I kept seeing it at my local library, and our friend, Alexa, who actually named this podcast, she kept saying to me, how do you like George Stevens and you haven't seen A Place in the Sun? And she also she also tells me I need to see Gunga Din. And she can never understand why I hadn't seen them. So finally one night I said, okay, I'm going to watch A Place in the Sun. And I read the box, and I'm sure the box is a little bit different, but let's just say here that the synopsis, and it has a 7.8, which means that's very high on Internet Movie Database. Poor boy gets a job working for his rich uncle and ends up falling in love with two women. Now, on the surface, that just sounds like a blues song. It sounds like life. It sounds like you never know who you're going to fall in love with, or should you fall in love. But then these, I remember thinking it was one of the slowest movies I'd ever seen. I remember thinking, how did George Stevens get the best directing Oscar for this?
Okay.
I was so just like, okay, this is a love story, and there's no drama, and this has a, so I just want to be correct here, so I'm going to click on nominations, because six Oscars is good. It has director, screenplay, so I remember thinking, okay, I'm going to see best directing, best writing, and then it has best cinematography, which that's huge. Costume design, film editing, and score. The only ones that didn't win were Montgomery Clift, Shelley Winters, and George Stevens for producing Best Picture. Now, as we, I'm about to dive into what went on for me, we're going to see why the Academy could have never given it Best Picture, given the content then. In 50s peak conservative America. I mean, we're talking America before the Beatles, before guys whose hair touched their eyebrows was considered long hair. And so with that, as Jim was saying, his wife falls in the water and he has an opportunity to, and this, as much as it sounds like a spoiler, it's still a must-see film to see the way it was played out, to see the way they got away with playing it out, to see how it was even, how you got people to go along with it. And he basically doesn't do everything it takes to help his wife from drowning because he's in love with Elizabeth Taylor.
Well, you know, the thing is, I don't remember specifically, but I don't think they were married. The characters weren't.
You know what? It's let me look this up because it was either married or they were engaged because they were on a trip that was some sort of honeymoon or to go celebrate, because I remember they were out of the way in the cabin on a lake.
While you're looking it up, could you see, was she pregnant?
In real life?
No, in the her character. Shelley
Winters. Oh, okay. Here, let me get to the trivia thing, because the trivia here will have all kinds of goop. But as we look at the trivia here, and great idea, Jim, I think we could all, I mean, just really take a step back and think a time when you couldn't even show a mammary gland in a film, and you have a guy who lets his wife drown. What kind of fluke was this that, and of course a great cast, Raymond Burr and some other great actors of the 50s. Let's see, I'm going to get right here. Storyline. Let me see if it says anything about marriage. Okay, it says Alice was pregnant. The woman who was killed, and Angela introduces him at a local high society, and they fall in love with George, which is Montgomery Clift. Sorry, this print is so bad, it's making my eye, but yes, you were right. There was a pregnancy involved, which ups the ante even more on the censorship. We have a tagline of one of the greatest love stories of all time. I mean, what is that saying? Is that saying who you love, you eventually want to kill? I'm not being facetious. I'm being I mean, where was, I wouldn't even know where to look, who was running Paramount Pictures at the time to let this even fly. This made, now think 1950s money, this made $2.3 million at the box office.
And Paul, I think it was, you know, not so much about, you know, the idea that this love story and killing the woman you're in love with, but it was more of a social commentary in that he had started off so poor and then raised up to the point where he was smitten with a woman of another class. You know, and they say America is not a class society, but it is. And that was the reasoning, as far as I can remember, why he was so willing to not marry, you know, and he had to, in his own mind, get rid of his wife and the, you know, with the baby and the whole thing so that he would be free to marry.
Oh, yeah, that's a really... I really like that observation, and that's, you know, honestly, that's, I mean, gosh, I say that there's like 100 things that are my favorite things about movies, but that's what I think is the most important thing about film, is the way that just someone else can just catch the slightest difference, and it can make the movie completely different. It's definitely why I see no point in arguing about films, or because there's every angle can provide you with something. I mean, I wasn't, completely forgot about her being pregnant. I'm so glad you brought that up. Thank you for bringing that up.
Yeah. Cause it was like I said, you know, we talk about our difference in ages, but I was young at the time that I saw that. And I think that her pregnancy and he let her die really was part of what upset me, you know, about the movie. Because I don't remember anything else very well from the movie except the ending.
Oh, right. Yeah, I mean, it's such one of those films. Our young generation and my generation would think of Full Metal Jacket the way it's a boot camp movie and a war movie, and they couldn't just make 2 1-hour movies. The tone just takes such a change, and all of a sudden it's the suspense kind of, oh my gosh. And as I'm looking here at some of the trivia, it says Shelley Winters developed mixed feelings towards director George Stevens for making her look so unglamorous alongside Elizabeth Taylor. Her role typecast her in mousy or brassy parts for years. She said she drove a white Cadillac convertible similar to Taylor's in the film for years afterwards to compensate for her intense feelings of inferiority while making the film. And I think Stevens definitely tapped into some crazy stuff in that movie. Just even though it's fake and the water was probably 2 inches deep or 2 feet deep on the Paramount lot, or there was divers, rigs, whatever, and Montgomery Clift obviously would have jumped off the boat if the actress was really in trouble. The way that scene is so played out with so much craziness in it. Another little fact that pops up here that I might hold some relevance for the way box office changed with censorship. It says the box office failure of the 1931 adaptation of an American tragedy prompted the filmmakers to seek an alternative title. One such title was The Prize. There was a $100 award for whoever could come up with the best new title, and George Stevens' associate successfully pitch for A Place in the Sun, although he never received his $100 reward. So in typical Hollywood fashion, you don't get paid. But this film, I highly suggest. I don't know which three I would tell someone to go and grab first. I would say definitely Virginia Woolf is not a date movie. Giant has some great lessons about the greed of man and what oil can do to people, like our past presidents, and A Place in the Sun. I mean, murdering your date, that's not really that's the mood for the evening.
You said that there was a make of it before in, what was it, 31? I'd like to see that, because, I mean, at that time, was that before or after the censorship board?
Let me see. I would have to look that up, because I know that the censorship board was still not as heavy-handed, but there was still a production code in the 50s, because they were submitting scripts. I know Joseph Breen, I mean, this, for all you listeners out there, if you don't know, this is, I mean, think of what our movies would be nowadays, that a production code of the government had to read the scripts and make sure that there was no body parts shown or too much kissing or violence, and had to give it an okay to be made. And that is why we got into things like the French New Wave, and why the French were able to do what they did and influence film. You know, that's what I love so much about French films, is you can kind of like, when I watch a French film, I'm waiting for someone to just like chop off someone's head in the first scene, because it's just like, well, if he's mad enough to cut off her head, then he's going to. Jim, if you had to pick, like we said, neither three is the greatest set the mood, but if you had to tell someone that they had to go out and watch one of these three, which one would you tell someone that they should go check out first?
I think I would have a hard time. I'd probably be going back and forth between Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf and Giant. Although, you know, I have a real, we sometimes get a real personal connection with a movie. But at the same time, you know, I had that for Virginia Woolf. And Giant was another one of those movies, though, that just, you know, it stayed with me, and it always will. And it dealt with more than just, James Dean's character trying to get the money and the oil and the whole thing. It was, that was there, you know, and it didn't work for him as far as that type of motivation. But the motivation, one of the subtexts in the movie, and I read somewhere that someone said that it was even, that it might have been the director's idea to really point out as far as, you know, what was going on in society at that time, the fact that there was the whole story of the Mexican wife and the children and how they were treated, how Rock Hudson's character, I think, even went through some growth around that idea. And, it was just there in the movie, throughout the movie. And, you know, really sort of, I can give kudos to Hollywood to the director for doing that at that time, and doing it in such a way without saying this is about, it just was implicit throughout the movie, the script, the totality of it.
Oh, right. I mean, and it was, I mean, I didn't catch obviously half as many things as I thought at age 20 or 21. What I really want to mention, as we run into our last 4 minutes here, I'll talk for about a minute and a half, and then I'll turn it over to Jim for his closing 2 minutes, and then we'll wrap up the show, and we will just save our surprises for next week. You're just going to have to tune in. You're just going to have to start putting on your calendar. We will occasionally let things out here or there so we can mark it, but we're not going to spill all the beans anymore like we used to. What I wanted to say about Giant was, if you're one of those people, Giant is in color, but if you're one of those people who likes to say you can't watch anything in black and white or you can't watch anything made before Star Wars, Giant 1956, heavy, heavy influence on the Paul Thomas Anderson movie There Will Be Blood from 2007. Daniel Day-Lewis won the Oscar, taking his son around to find gold and to take people's money from their gold field and drill for oil. And Paul Thomas Anderson even said that that was his influence. I saw an interview with him and Martin Scorsese, and he said that was 100% what I meant the movie to be. So if you have no incentive other than that you like Paul Thomas Anderson, and you like There Will Be Blood, check out Giant. It's always great to see a movie that's a derivative of another film. Before I return for my maintenance, I'll turn it over to you, Jim, for your closing 2 minutes.
Well, when you said that influence and how it, you know, it reverberates, there was a, I'm pretty sure it was on TV, and it was called Welcome Back to the Five and Dime, Jimmy Dean, Jimmy Dean. And Cher was in it. And I think it was one of their first movies that I saw, you know, that was based on, you know, at least the title was based on James Dean. That whole fame and legend and the whole bit was the basic backstory on, you know, Welcome Back. And just beautifully done, but it takes place in a town where Giant was filmed. And there's this whole story built. So it just, you know, the repercussions of that, not, as far as movies are, you know, what was made and what's picked up from stuff and remeshed and the whole thing. But just to, you know, for a sort of a light note on Elizabeth Taylor, who I, you know, hands down, you know, I bow before her. There was a joke, I think it was from Phyllis Diller, that said, you know, Elizabeth went through those periods where she put a lot of weight on. This beautiful woman would just put some weight on. And Phyllis Diller said that when her pierced, if you got her pierced ears and squeezed them where they were pierced, gravy would come out. And she would have appreciated that, and she probably did at the time, because that woman, for all that she had going in her life, was, you know, basically just she was centered. That was her life, and she negotiated it beautifully.
Right. I mean, I appreciate you sharing all this, because it gives me a new way to want to go back. And I know Cat of the Hot Tin Roof is at my library, and I've been thinking about going back to The Hustler and Paul Newman and HUD, and Butch and Sundance is on Netflix. And but yeah, so we got down to 20 seconds left here, so I just want to say thank you, Jim. We will be back with our more on Elizabeth Taylor, and hopefully getting our friend to come on and talk about Giant. With that, I'm down to 10 seconds, so I'm going to say aloha, and thank you for joining us, and thank you for joining us, Jim, and have a good night, everyone.